I went through 9 sexual abusers from the age of like a little baby right through to 14 when I had an abortion from one of the abusers. So it's been quite an ordeal. And then there was the physical abuse as well as the sexual abuse. And then there was the neglect as well.
Did your nan not have any clue that these people were taking advantage of you?
My nan was an abuser too, and so was my mum. So my caregivers were abusers too. So all I think about now is, obviously, I've got God in my life now, and I know that you have to forgive. And my thoughts on it now are, they must have gone through something themselves for that to happen to me. I don't hold no bad grudges. I'm not trying to say, oh, these women are terrible women. They put me in all these areas, and they knew some of these were paedophiles. But, you know, it is what it is. You know, I'm not trying to say that's what made me drink or take drugs. I'm just saying it made me a bit of an oddball.
I'm Paul Scolfort, and this is Powerful. In this series, I come clean about my own sobriety and the journey it took for me to get here. In each episode, I will speak to a special guest about their addictions and how they achieve sobriety and how they maintain a happy lifestyle today. Today, I'm delighted to welcome the lovely Carol. We are privileged to hear Carol's incredible story, which began with unspeakable trauma and abuse at a young age, which led to escaping with drugs, alcohol when she was a teen, and eventually finding sobriety at the age of 51. More than that, the self-actualization that Carol has managed through her recovery and the work that she does to create a safe space for local children is making a tremendous impact on their lives and so many around her. So in some of these episodes, there will be discussions of alcohol misuse, drugs, sexual abuse, suicide, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. Carol, thank you so much for being here on This Is Powerful.
Thank you for inviting me.
I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Me too.
Can I ask you straight off, how long have you been sober?
Nearly 17 years. Next week, 17 years.
That's amazing. And can I ask you how old you are?
68 in October.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
I'm only young.
I know. I thought you was younger. But that's amazing. That's really, really good. I'd love to know a bit about your background, Carol, and where you're from, where you was born, where you grew up.
Right. Well, I was born in Tunbridge Wells in a baby unit for children that were having mums that were single in the 50s. I'm a GI baby, which is a government issue. My dad was an American GI. So I was up for adoption in Tunbridge Wells. And after 3 months, my biological nan took me on. But she got a shock because she didn't know I'd be of mixed race. No one said. My mum never said that she'd slept with this man.
How did you find out then? Did your mum say that she had a baby?
I got all the stories, the backstories from all the family as years went by. So, yeah, that's how I lived in Dover till I was about 16 and a half.
Was that with your...
With my nan, my biological nan, who was a Romany gypsy.
Okay.
So there was quite a lot of begging and borrowing and stealing and things being put in the buggy, you know, that sort of stuff.
Yeah. So she basically, well, really, I guess she saved your life now by taking you on and taking you down there.
Yeah, she did.
What happened to your mum at that point?
She went and started a new life in London. Yeah, that's the kind of thing that used to happen back then.
Yeah.
The grandmothers would bring up the child and the mum would start a new life.
Oh, it was completely different though then, wasn't it?
It really was.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So how was life with grandma in Dover? And were you wondering, is this my mum? Or did you know that she was your grandma?
No, I didn't know. I thought she was my mum. Ah. And I thought when I met my mum that she was my auntie. Very confusing.
Is that what you was told?
Yeah, this is Auntie Clara, but Clara was my mum. You know, Isabella was my nan, but I called her mum.
And was Isabella married or was she single?
She was married, but when I came to the family home at 3 months old, I was told my granddad left home for 2 weeks because of the shame of bringing me there.
Yeah. Right.
The pride.
There was a lot of weird stuff back
there
then.
There really was.
There's so many stories in my family of shifty things happening.
Yes.
So how was life in Dover?
Well, it wasn't great. I'm going to be absolutely honest with you, Paul. It wasn't great. I went through 9 sexual abusers from the age of like a little baby right through to 14 when I had an abortion from one of the abusers. So it's been quite an ordeal. And then there was the physical abuse as well as the sexual abuse. And then there was the neglect as well. So all in all, I didn't have the greatest childhood. Plus, being of mixed race in Dover at that time, I was the only mixed race child in that in the schools that I went to. So there was a lot of bullying.
So was the not to pry anymore, but did your nan not have any clue that these people were taking advantage of you?
My nan was an abuser too, and so was my mum. So my caregivers were abusers too. Okay. So all I think about now is, obviously, I've got God in my life now, and I know that you have to forgive. And my thoughts on it now are, they must have gone through something themselves for that to happen to me. I don't hold no bad grudges. I'm not trying to say, oh, these women are terrible women. They put me in all these areas, and they knew some of these were paedophiles. But, you know, it is what it is. You know, I'm not trying to say that's what made me drink or take drugs. I'm just saying it made me a bit of an oddball.
Honestly, I'm not surprised. It's amazing that you're sitting here and sharing your story, and that you can have forgiveness. That's incredible. Were you aware of alcohol or drugs when you were growing up?
Yeah, they're both alcoholics, you see. There was lots of parties. All sorts went on, you know.
But if your mum was in London...
Yeah, she used to come weekends now and again.
Ah, I see.
Yeah. Gotcha. There was prostitution, and so occasionally these men would obviously want to be in the same bed as me with my mum. So them sort of things happened as well. Things like, you know, when they say little girls should be seen and not heard, or little girls should not, you know, some things you shouldn't really know at a young age, but I did.
Yeah.
And then there's all that trying to people, I know what it is now, people pleasing, trying to engage the room and work out what you're meant to say, what you're meant to do to keep it all happy.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the arguments after they had a good drink together, my nan and my mum, would end up being about me. And then first of all, it's fun. It's like they're laughing, they're playing music, they're dancing. And then they start fighting, and physical fighting as well as verbally, you know.
Yeah. And then that's terrible for a child. Isn't it?
The on the stairs thinking, oh, I didn't. Why am I here? Who am I? Why am I causing all this trouble?
Yeah,
that sort of thing.
Sad, isn't it, that you become the victim of that
Of that situation. It's not my shame, but it's theirs.
And it's interesting, isn't it? Because it's amazing how someone so young can try to sort things out.
Yeah.
Innocently, if I behave like that, then maybe they won't argue. Yeah. If I say this, then maybe it won't go wrong. Yeah.
Or if they're lying, try and make out they're not lying. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Try and smooth it over. You know. I realise now that I was infected by this madness when I was young, and it still affects me now as an adult.
Yeah.
But it just doesn't affect me in quite the same way.
Yeah.
You know, I've done a lot of work on myself. And, you know, I remember when you got me into counselling, that was very powerful. And it got me to know who I really am, and that the shame don't belong to me and things like that. So that's why I'll always be grateful for your friendship and what you've done for me.
Oh, I appreciate it, Carol.
Yeah.
That was our goal with Stride Foundation, wasn't it, to help?
Yeah.
To help people.
Yeah.
When did you discover alcohol yourself?
At 14,
Was it like a wow moment, or was it kind of like everyone else is doing it, so I'm...
I think I'd tried drink along the way, but 14, after the abortion from one of the sexual abusers, I went into some kind of like very... Well, I was treated quite badly in the hospital. Well, obviously, at 14, you know, the nurses don't know that it's an abuser that's got me pregnant. They're just thinking I'm a nasty little girl, which, you know, nasty little girl, but it wasn't my fault sort of thing. But, you know, I look at it now and I think, oh, I don't know. That's when I just thought, I don't care anymore. I don't really care. I'm going to just go for it. And I just did.
Life's probably so painful.
Yeah, and I was taking a lot of drugs at 14 because you get a lot of drugs off the boats in Dover at that time.
It?
Yeah.
Oh,
so I was taking drugs and drink, and I was really going for it.
What kind of drugs?
LSD, speed, you know, uppers, downers sort of things. Yeah. Weed. It wasn't weed like cannabis. It was like the solid. You used to get a lot of solid off the boats, and so I'd be having weed, and I was always on speed. And you know, the LSD, I'm glad I had a bad trip with the LSD because I didn't take it again, but I did try it, you know.
Funny, isn't it? Because alcohol and drugs are a painkiller.
Yeah.
Emotionally, mentally, physically. So, you know, a lot of people experience trauma to certain degrees. I mean, that yours is obviously, it's terrible. It's terrible, actually, to hear as well. But how else do you cope with it?
This is it. I couldn't cope.
Yeah.
That's why I had to push all the feelings down, stuff them down.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not a victim here, you know. I'm not a victim when I say these stories. Mm. This is just my life. This is my truth, you know. Today I'm happy, you know. I'm glad I don't drink or take drugs anymore. I'm glad I'm getting to know who the real Carol is.
Yeah.
You know.
It takes a lot of courage to do that.
Yeah, it does.
So after sort of, was you still in Dover at 14?
Yes, because I had the abortion in Buckland Hospital.
Yeah.
I came to London at 16 and a half.
Was that on your own or
yes,
did you come up?
To come and try and live with my mum, my biological mum.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how did that work out?
It didn't work out very well. Sadly, after a year, I had to go and find a bedsit somewhere to live. Yeah. I was going to end up killing her, you know, because of her drinking and my drinking.
Yeah.
And I was trying to work. Oh, it was really bad. Yes.
What was your first job?
I worked in High Grade Meats. It's like a little factory in Peckham. And my mum was very excited when she heard me talking on the antennae, calling different people. I went on to nice jobs like Yves Saint Laurent in the city, and I went on to nice jobs. But I mean, really, my first jobs as a teenager was in the fields, you know. So summer holidays were hop picking.
Yeah.
You know, then there was apple picking, strawberry picking, you know, you name it, we picked it.
Which was probably a nice little bit, no?
It was nice. And yeah. I mean, you get up at 5, you're back at bed, you're in bed by about 8.
My dad talks about that. He romanticises about it.
There's quite a lot there there's quite a lot there that was fun.
So when you started working the meat place,
yes,
hanging off the tannoy.
High grade meats, yeah, yeah.
Did you feel a sense that, like, maybe you're getting on your feet and maybe you're got something here because you've got your own money so you can do your own things rather than being relying on to an adult?
An adult, yeah. Well, that's where the problem came, because my stepfather, who was Irish, he used to say, don't give her the money, like me, your mum, don't give her the money because she'd just drink it. So I used to give the money to him. Otherwise, we wouldn't get much food.
And was he in the same household?
He was in the same house at that time, yes.
Was he a good man?
He was a lovely man. He was one of the best men I think I've ever met.
Really?
Such a gentle man, really was. And it's sad because the illness of alcoholism gives you paranoia. And my mum got paranoid thinking something was going on between me and him. It's really strange.
Mm.
But he was just a very kind man.
But you probably sensed of safety and genuine human being.
Yeah, I did.
Which is attractive, isn't it? But I mean...
Yeah.
And what happened to him?
He died of alcoholism, unfortunately, but he wasn't a nasty drunk.
Yeah.
She was a nasty drunk and so was I. I mirrored, Paul, all what I'd learnt. So from a little girl, I'd seen that the drinking causes fights and arguments. I've seen that, you know, this and that happens, things go on and madness goes on.
Yeah.
And I just copied, and police were always called. And in the end, my drinking, it was police were called because... Well, not to my house, but to the pubs where I'd start.
But before then, how did you get to work in Yves Saint Laurent? Like, how long did you work for the
meat place?
Oh, I worked
there for about 2 years. I loved it. I have a lot of masks, Paul. You know, so in Yves Saint Laurent, I'd try and talk very posh.
How did you get that job?
Oh, I just applied for it, made out, had all these, I was a terrible liar.
Well, it sounds like it's pretty good if you got in there.
I got in there with no qualifications, but making out, I had all these qualifications.
Yeah.
And I spoke in this certain way, trying to be very posh, you know, speaking to ladies and lords. Mm. But really, my voice, as you know, it's quite a common voice, really. Not to put myself down, but I'm just a bog standard. This is who I am.
So when I did my first voice coaching.
Yeah.
And I said exactly the same thing to my voice coach. I said, you know, I've got an Eastern accent and I mumble and I clip my words. I said, so it's just the bog standard. And she went, stop right there. She goes, you know how many people can't do that accent? And do you know where it comes from and why it is that? And she gave me this whole lecture on that if you would have been near the docks, you would have breathed differently and shallow. You would have used less words because you'd have been inhaling all these toxins and stuff. And it just comes down the line. She goes, so don't you ever say that about it.
Amazing, isn't it?
Fair enough.
Yeah, I won't do that again.
Thank you for that.
Yeah.
So, and what happened with Yves Saint Laurent? How did that job go?
Well, I ended up stealing from there, unfortunately, and they got rid of me. I kept making that I didn't understand the till, but I was stealing the money.
Because you needed money for drink or?
It wasn't just drink. It was the man that I was with at the time was a bit of a, he was kind of like coaxing me to do it as well, because a lot of money goes through that shop.
Yeah,
I've made my amends now, But it was a long time coming. Yeah. I mean, it's not till I kind of got into a 12-step program that I realised you have to make an amends for these naughty things that you do.
When it come to fruition and they decided to get rid of you, what happened then? So you was with this guy, was you living with this guy?
Yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
Very naughty, yeah.
So, and when that happened, what happened after then?
Well, I got other jobs like in Wallace's. I went from different jobs, like, you know, just kind of all over the place in the city. Yeah, yeah. Just different, just bumping along, you know.
What, just so to get
just
money?
To get
buy.
Money, yeah, yeah.
At that point, how old was you at that point?
The point that I was working there was about 18, 19. Because High Grade Meats took me in a lot. That was the first job. They thought I was 18 already.
Right.
And I wasn't. So, I mean, these are the days you could go in and out of jobs.
Yeah.
You could have one job 1 minute and get rid of you there. You go down the road and get another job.
So the care wasn't there as well.
That's it. Yeah.
Were you still in contact with your grandma and your mum at this point?
Well, not very often with my mum. I mean, there was a time when my drinking got very bad and I did used to drink with her in the parks. Like, you know, on the embankment under the Oxo Tower.
Which, did she have a home then, Carol?
She had a lovely home in Blackfriars, an absolutely beautiful home.
Wow.
Most people bought their homes there.
Yeah.
But she didn't. But, you know, she had a lovely home, but she preferred the park. And
did
there was
she
a
ever
stage.
Work?
She worked in the gin factory.
That's I you can't make that up. Are you serious?
Yeah.
Where?
And when she got the sack, that she said, I only ever drink tea. But she's been drinking the gin.
I mean, you couldn't work in a better place, could you?
You can't make it up. She was comical, my mum, in some ways.
So when she drank in the parks, had she already finished work at that point?
No, she didn't work for long.
Yeah.
No, she didn't work for long. She was just like, basically, dossing about, really, in the park. Yeah.
How did she get her money?
From stealing, doing a bit of, you know, skullduggery here and there,
yeah.
You know. It's all from the gypsy, really, going right back to the gypsy kind of, you've got to try and work brain, you know, try and get a bit of money here and there.
Yeah.
Ducking and diving, really.
How was it when you saw your mum in the parks at first? Did you ever clock
it, first, yeah,
really?
No. When I worked in East London, when I used to go past Camberwell, because we lived in Peckham.
Yeah.
That's where I first come, Peckham. And I'd be going through Camberwell Green on the bus towards Elephant and Castle.
Yeah, I know.
Oh my goodness, when I just see her in the park and I just hear people say, oh, look at the state of that woman in that park. You know, and other people, look at them, they're disgusting. I used to think, yeah, they are. But really, I was going that way myself. At that time, I couldn't see it.
Yeah.
I used to look down my nose at it, but I ended up in the parks
but
as
that's
well.
The thing, we was talking about this before, about no one sets out to be an alcoholic or
no.
Sets out to be addicted to something.
Mm-mm.
And at one point you just cross that line, don't you?
And then it's just no more social drinking. It's every day.
So you obviously, when you saw your mum there and you heard people saying that, how did that make you feel?
Well, I felt embarrassed. Yeah. I mean, I used to be able to smoke on the buses upstairs them times. So I was just pulling on my fag a bit harder, making out I don't know who the woman is.
Yeah.
Because she'd always be fighting in the park. And that's what I used to do in the end. It's like copycat and mirror and everything.
When did you start drinking in the park?
I started drinking in the park when I was about 40. I had blackouts in the park.
You waited for a while then?
I waited for a while. No, I went into all the pubs first, got barred from a few of those.
What area was this?
This was this was East London now. Because I was moving about a lot. Because I thought if I move about, people won't know me in the area. I start all over again, you know, fresh slate.
So if you're saying that to yourself, you know you're up to no good, right?
Yeah, yeah. So yeah. I was in Hackney, Leighton, Chingford. You name it, I was all over the place. But in Chingford, I caused the most damage, I think.
Why? What happened to you?
I just got into a terrible state one time and caused a very, very big fight to happen. And unfortunately, all my children got hurt because of me wanting a drink.
Right.
That was my rock bottom, really. But I was the talk of Chingford for ages. And some of the people I worked with in the school, they saw me. It was the most embarrassing evening.
So you was working in school at a point?
Yeah.
What was you working as?
I was just doing, like, helping in the nursery and then, you know, just different things. I'd done different things in schools. Like, mostly I worked in private nurseries, but sometimes in schools with the under fives.
So you have that care inside.
Oh, I've got a lovely care inside, yeah. But it's not when I've not got a drink in me, I'm fine.
Yeah.
It's when I put that drink in me or that drug in me that it all goes a bit left.
Did you have moments of sobriety while she was working there?
Yeah, I did. I had 7 years because I got into the church. I became a born-again Christian in 1991.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I didn't smoke, I didn't take drugs or drink for 7 years.
Wow.
And then something happened. I can't remember what it was now. Something quite...
Was that like a decision that, was you like, I'm not doing this?
I'm not doing
then
this.
Then I'm joining the church. So you joined the church.
No, I joined the church first, yeah. Became a Christian.
Yeah.
Was asking, you know, Jesus to help me with everything and he was helping me and I just stopped everything.
Wow.
7 years I was. And then whatever it was that happened, I went to a party and thought, oh, God, you know, I must be all right now. I can have just one. I'm a Christian now. I can have one. And obviously that one turned to me getting alcoholic poisoning because I drank so much.
Wow. How old was you then?
About 45.
How was that period for being sober for 7 years?
It was hard. Yeah, no, not it was a great time to be sober. But what I mean is once I crossed over and went back out again, I kind of, what they call backslidden, you know, it wasn't good fun. And people from the church nearby where I was going, they'd see me and they'd talk to me and say, what are you doing? What's happened? And I'd just say, oh, don't look at me. Don't judge me. Don't this, don't, you know, all of that crap. And, yeah, I felt disgusted with myself.
It's hard, isn't it? Because for people who don't know that aren't afflicted with alcoholism or addiction is that if you have a break for a long period of time, it's easy to stop.
Yeah.
But staying stop's difficult.
That's right.
And I remember doing like 3 months and 4 months and thinking, oh, I'm all right. And the mind would say, well, you're clearly fine now. Why don't you have a drink or why don't you, you know, use a drug? But usually that's why a lot of heroin addicts die because they go straight back to the same what they was using before and the tolerance has gone down.
That's right.
After that day of the first drinking after 7 years, what was your mindset? Were you kind of like, fuck, I'm here now, so I might as well stay?
That's exactly it. That ignorance came back like, oh, I'm here now.
Yeah.
Pardon me, and I thought people were judging me anyway, so I thought, they're judging me anyway, so who cares? Because you go into some very, I don't know if you did, Paul, but I go into some very deep, dark thinking about myself when I'm drinking.
No, I'm perfect.
Yeah, of course you are,
never
my friend.
Done that at all.
Of course you are.
Oh, there's definitely something, there's definitely an internal narrative that when you talk to people that have suffered from this, that are just their worst critics, literally. And there is actually, I spoke to Professor Nutt, and there is science about paranoia and why you get paranoid and these thoughts, especially if you've had a tough upbringing.
Yes.
It's bound to happen.
Yeah.
It's bound to happen because it's that old saying, isn't it? You compare your insides to the outside to someone else.
Yes.
So you compare your emotions and your thought process to what you see. Mm. And the sums always come to zero for yourself.
Yeah. Yeah.
But how's your mindset now? Because you completely know yourself.
Well, I do. I came in at 51. So, yeah, this time. I mean, I tried at 23. I mean, I was an alcoholic and a drug addict at 14. There's no doubt about it. I knew it, yeah.
Right.
I knew it was going to be a very downward spiral.
And you just was on that?
From that time, just onwards, it was a bit like putting my fingers up to the world, basically.
Yeah, I bet.
But at 51, I was back in the church. I was...
What brought you back?
I felt that I had a suicide attempt, and I cried out to God to help me, and I knew in my heart that if I was to do something terrible to myself, I would definitely not be going to heaven. I knew in my heart that if you commit, it's in the Bible, I think, or somewhere that I've read that, you know, if you commit suicide, it's not what God would want for you, because you'd be killing the wrong person as well. I realised, you know, killing the drunk Carol wouldn't be the real Carol that's sitting here today.
Yeah.
So I knew that even though I'd done it, I knew I took these tablets and had a drink and just laid there and took the position. And when I come around the next day, I thought, no, I've got to get back to church. I've got to get back into the family and the fold of the church so I can get prayer and get some deliverance. I need some deliverance here. And I got some deliverance.
That's the amazing thing is about addiction and alcoholism is that it separates us from everybody.
It does.
It's so lonely. You can be in a room full of people and feel like you're on your own.
Exactly
that. So really, connection was, you were smart there because connection was what you needed, right?
It really was.
How was
walking back? I felt ashamed going back in the first Sunday. I had my head down and the people just welcomed me with loving arms. I mean, they're not there to judge me.
Yeah.
But my head was telling me when I was drinking, they're all there to judge me now, you know.
Clever way of keeping you drinking.
Yeah, I mean, the church I went to before, I had a fight in there once after I started drinking again. I had a fight in there with someone. You don't normally have a fight in church with someone and then four or five of the men, deacons and elders have to take you off the woman.
Hmm.
That's not normal.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, it might be if you're drinking all the time.
Yeah, it was normal because I was drinking all the time, but it's not normal now. When I look back on it, it's quite shameful.
Why did you move from, when you said that you went from Hackney to
Leighton to Chingford?
Yeah, was that because of incidents happened? Or?
Yeah, that was because of different relationships. And what I'd done is, because I've grown up with this my nan, and she was a bit kind of narcissistic, if that's the right word. That's the sort of men that I felt I needed. I needed men that are going to, you know, because I didn't know what it was like to have a dad, because I didn't have a dad. When they'd beat me or do things, because when I had a drink, my mouth would get loose and I'd just be like, I'd be talking like, you know, like a bit like a gangster granny, I don't know. And they'd think, she's lost the plot here, let's give her a smack, you know, give her a beating. But what's terrible about this, Paul, is that even after getting beaten, I still wouldn't want them to leave me. I didn't want rejection and abandonment like I'd had already. That's how crazy the thinking pattern is.
But that's how, when you have those deep scars and learned behaviour, especially before the age of seven, it's like hardwired, isn't it?
It is hardwired.
And it makes no sense as a mature lady who knows herself now, who's sort of sober and worked on herself.
Yeah.
It's sad, isn't it? When you look back, you think, God.
Why did I go through all that? And why do I keep going to the same type of person all the time? You know, that.
The amount of people that do that is phenomenal.
It really is,
isn't
it?
You have to know yourself and be strong enough to walk away from what's familiar and what's, you know, habits.
That's right. Yeah.
So did you have children?
Yes, I've got three.
Three?
And five grandchildren, yeah.
Oh, lovely.
They're all adults.
How
I love them
the
very much. Sorry?
How old are
My son's 44.
Yeah.
My daughter is 35 and my other daughter's 33. Sorry, hang on. It's 3 years difference, 32.
And how was that to then be the mother?
Yeah, that was hard because I traumatised my kids with my behaviour as well. So it's like traumatised mum, traumatised the kids.
Mm.
I didn't sexually abuse my children, thank God. But mentally and emotionally, I weren't always there. So they had to kind of put up with me saying, I'm only going out for a drink, one or two drinks. I'll be back in an hour. And I meant I'll be back in an hour. I never knew that once you start drinking, that phenomenon of craving comes on you and it's all gone. You don't care about the time or what you've said. So they went through a lot with me. They went through a lot. They saw a lot of violence. They just saw too many things again, too many things.
Yeah.
Again, me mirroring what I knew. And I'm always trying to make an amends to them now. But what I find is now and again, they might just dig you out a bit, if what I call it, dig you out, like, you know, just remind you about that, remind you about this. And it's okay, because they have to be able to be authentic with me. But what's different about me now, Paul, is I don't take on the shame of it, because this is not who I am now. So for 17 years, this is a different Carol. This is not the Carol that was acting out down there or messing about up the pub or causing a fight at the off licence. This is a new Carol that's got a new way of life.
Yeah.
So I kind of demand a bit more respect. And they're getting it now.
That's great.
They're getting it very slowly. I mean, even calling me Carol instead of mum, don't matter what kind of mum I've been, I'm still your mum.
Hmm.
So I won't even have you call me Carol. If you call me Carol, I'll ignore you.
Yeah.
This is the strength I'm getting from being in recovery, Paul.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's sad, isn't it? Because hurt people hurt.
They really do. They really do.
And you have to go through some massive personal change, which takes courage. But if you're the sibling, if you're the child or relative, you might not respect that initially.
No.
Because it's your internal journey, isn't it?
Yeah.
But to change, to come from everything you've come from and and be sober and not need to have that as a painkiller.
No,
all the time.
No more.
Takes a lot
That's
of
right.
a lot of courage. It can be done.
Yeah. I can remember them being very cross that AA got me, sorry, I shouldn't say that word, but the 12-step yeah. program got me sober in a way. Some of the people I went to and the meetings I went to,
yeah.
I think they were quite cross that these people, they didn't know these people, and all of a sudden these people were there trying to help me. And they've been asking me for years to stop drinking.
Yeah.
You know, got a little bit like, oh, who are these people? You know, how come they can get us sober and we couldn't?
Which would make sense.
Yeah.
And then that's when you can tell the love's there as well.
Yes,
I had
can.
It was funny because I made an amends to an ex-girlfriend and it was very strange. She's not English. She lived in Europe. And we had a really strong relationship for a couple of years and it was perfect on paper.
Mm.
And I was never a bad boyfriend because I wasn't a horrible boyfriend. I was really loving, but I'd say the same thing. I'm just going to pop out. I won't come back for a whole day.
Yeah.
Not realizing I won't come back for a whole day. But this particular girl, I phoned her up and I just said, I really wanted to say, I'm so sorry for how I behaved and let you down in different ways. And I remember I was in Los Angeles at the time and she was in Miami and she flew over to try and fix, was at her last legs.
Mm.
I thought it would be a good idea to have a shot of whiskey, smoke a joint before I go to meet her. And all I had to do was drive, for those people who know, was literally drive from Franklin Boulevard down to Sunset Boulevard, and it's like 2 miles.
Right.
3 hours later, I'm still trying to find the way. And I know this, like the back of my hand, because I was so tripping out on what I smoked.
Yeah.
Pulled over to ask someone directions at the time, and this guy tried to jump in and grab the key. So I had a physical fight with this fella.
Gosh.
Drove off. By the time I'd pulled up where she was, all I wanted to do was give her a cuddle and say, I love you, I'm so sorry. I get there, she's standing there with her hands on her hips and she said, where have you been? You're late again.
Yeah.
And then I just went, oh, that's it. I'm trying to fix this and you're just having, and I just blew up.
Yeah.
And that was the last thing. So I phoned her and I asked her where she was and she said, I'm actually in London. I was like, oh, are you? I said, whereabouts? And she said, I'm on this certain road. And I said, I'm on that road.
Wow.
And she said, whereabouts? I said, by the Esso garage. And she went, I'm literally coming up to the Esso garage. So I pulled in. You couldn't make this up.
You couldn't,
pulled in.
No.
I hadn't seen it for two, 3 years. Pulled into this garage and sat there. We had a face-to-face conversation. And what she said was, all I wanted to do was to help you.
Yeah.
That's all I wanted was you to be well. And it was lovely. We had a hug and stuff. She's married by that point. I said, I'm, you know, so glad you're doing well. And we left it on a really nice note. But it's in hindsight.
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
You know, seeing the things we do at the time, you just think everyone's being a pain telling me everything.
Mm.
So do you have any regrets?
Yeah, I do. I sometimes feel that I have to still mourn and grieve the Carol that wasted all those years and that didn't give my children what they needed. I feel quite emotional.
Yeah. I mean, it's an emotional topic. But now, do you feel that because you can be present with them and honest
yeah,
and
I mean,
stuff.
It's great. Yeah, I mean, I'm grateful for my grandchildren and, you know, one of them's never seen me drink,
which is
great. That's the one that done my eyelashes.
That's all right. Do you want a tissue?
No, I'm all right. Thank you. Yeah. I'm frightened the eyelashes might come off.
They look lovely. I'm quite jealous of those eyelashes, Carol.
I've never had them before.
Mine are getting faded as I get older. I don't know why.
I don't think men are meant to have them, Paul.
All the old movie stars had them, Carol.
Oh, did they? Okay, let me shut up there. Not going to dig myself a hole here.
Not that I'm comparing myself to a movie star. What makes you happy today?
What makes me happy is I still go into schools. I go into secondary schools as a volunteer now because obviously I'm a pensioner.
Yeah.
I love working with children still. And where I live, big people like adults and children call me Nanny Carol where I live on an estate. I've come from poor. I've come from no money. I've never had a lot of money, if you know what I mean. And I'm quite happy with that. But what I do is whatever I've got, I'll share. And it's just such a rewarding feeling. And then for those kids that are really going for a really hard time, I try and talk them out of getting into the gangs and, you know, taking things off them. Like I've taken knives off couple of boys before. Yeah, it's like, you don't need to go down this road, because if you are that person, you're going to end up in prison.
Yeah.
You know, and I know, you know, by the grace of God, I never end up in prison myself, but I got arrested a lot when I was drinking because I was crazy. But, you know, I just, you know, the adults call me Nanny Carol. They come down, can you help me, Nanny Carol? This has happened, or that one's hurt himself, or anything at all. I'm there today, like, for the community.
Yeah.
You know, and my daughters have done well because they've gone out and done great things in the community. One of them does. One's a matron in the community. One's works at Great Ormond Street. My girls have done amazing because I gave up the drink.
Yeah.
But if I hadn't, they wouldn't have gone to university, because they was at school when I was doing this.
That's incredible, because you've broke the chain.
I have broke the chain. And then my son, unfortunately, did have the, you know, the same as me. But, you know, out of three, I've got two that didn't pick it up, the alcoholism and the drug taking.
That's amazing. I'd like to be called Granddad something when I'm older. But that's lovely.
Yeah, Nanny Carol, yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing, because it says, you know, it's like being the matriarch.
Yes.
And trusted. And if someone's going to give you a knife, then they really respect you.
They do. Because I don't try and be above them. I show them that I'm on the same level.
Yeah.
And that, because where I've come from, I wouldn't like to see them go to prison. So there's quite a few that I've helped there.
Do you have any of the boys that rely on you then? Because that's...
There's some that come to me regularly, yeah.
Really?
There's some that stay over, which seems a bit strange, but they do.
Not really, it's a safe place.
It's a safe place. They've got a room there, you know. Even little ones that are like, you know, because I look after a lot of children, and it's all for free, because I like to give back freely what I've been given, if you know what I mean. But there's one little boy comes to me, and he's going to be six this weekend. And he says, Nanny Carol, I'm going in my bed. he's got his own bed. Because I've got a three-bedroom flat. He's got his own bed. Going in his bed to play on his iPad. And I think, this is so, you can't make it up. It's so natural.
I just can't believe when you think, this is the thing, when you think about what you've experienced in life, right?
Yeah.
Some people take their life, and you know, but you're providing a safe space, which is your own house, for people to come in and stay and know that they're perfectly fine.
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing when you think about it.
Yeah, I mean, domestic abuse. I've got people that come in running from domestic abuse.
Yeah.
They know that I've been there as well, so they come and they can feel quite comfortable. It's quite good to be able to give back this way.
It must feel really...
I feel God wants me to do that. That's what I feel. It's part of my calling.
Yeah.
You know.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
It's incredible to be... It's literally turning everything completely 180, isn't it?
Yeah. Have you ever had a rock bottom that's been really disgusting, that you feel really, really ashamed of?
Yeah, I had a few rock bottoms. It's funny when you say rock bottom, because usually that's the last stop, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I had lots of moments. I remember we were living in Los Angeles, joined an acting class and went there and didn't drink or do anything. I had this really lovely teacher called Janet L. Henty, and she took a shine to me and I took a shine to her. She was lovely. She was so hard on people, but I understand that hardness, you know, and I really liked her. I wasn't easily offended by her. And I worked really hard in her class, enjoyed it. And then some of the exercises we were doing really revealed what was going on inside. And I think I started to have a bit of a breakdown. When the period finished, she said, you can come into the masterclass, which was great. So I was like, that's amazing. But from that bit when we stopped, I just went off on a bender. And I remember eating in this really nice restaurant called Gitana on Sunset Boulevard with a friend of mine. And we was showing off and doing shots and stuff. And there was a lot of people from work there. And I remember I just collapsed on the table and I grabbed the table to try and steady myself and I fell on the floor.
Oh.
Everyone saw, obviously, because that doesn't really happen. And not many people drink there, to be honest. And I managed to dial a number, a friend of mine, Dave, at the time, said, Dave, pick me up, because I thought someone had put something in my drink.
Yes.
I thought I'd been spiked.
Yes.
And I remember bits, like Dave picking me up and then being on a grass verge, being sick, and then back in his car, and then being on another grass verge. Then I locked myself out of the house, so I slept on the doorstep. And you know, I'd come from being really, really successful to try and move into that area. And I was just a mess. And I just didn't understand why I was doing it. And I couldn't stop doing it. I literally, it was the shame of that. And growing up, I loved athletics. I was a gymnast, a boxer. I was a runner. Yeah. I did everything. And I loved that. So there was moments that felt like rock bottoms that I'd just sit there thinking, what happened? What are you doing?
Yeah.
And then I'd go to the gym, take vitamins, go to the beach, feel better after a couple of weeks. And then someone would say, do you want to come out? And I'd start again.
Yeah.
You know, and that feeling of powerless for someone who, growing up, until really about, I'd say probably 24, 25, felt very powerful, very confident. Appeared to have his stuff together, did well financially, did smart moves. And then it all started to fall apart. I had a couple of rock bottoms where I jolted into, like, I'm not going to drink anymore, I'm not going to party. And most of them was saying stupid stuff to people because I started to feel really anxious and uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So I would have to drink before I went out, just a shot or something to go into company. And then what you said earlier, my mind started to separate me from everyone saying, oh, you're just this working class kid.
Yes.
This is like 15 years into having an amazing career, by the way. And, you know, doing 100 flights a year and working on incredible jobs. My mind started to tell me the opposite. Oh, you're this, you're that, you're not good enough. You can't do this, and see the differences of what I couldn't do. And I think that for me was probably the biggest rock bottom than anything physical, was I felt like I was losing my mind.
Yeah.
I'd wake up in the morning and I'd have these negative thoughts and just couldn't get rid of them.
Yeah.
No matter what I tried. And before, I'd go for a run, I'd go to the gym, and I'd just clear my mind and I'd be fine.
Yeah.
So that for me felt like I was losing my power and my strength slowly. And I'd push it down a few times, but really it was a long rock bottom to realizing that I have just ruined my life.
Yeah.
I hadn't ruined my life because I found sobriety, thank God, like you. And then had my last rock bottom, I ended up going to a treatment center in North London. I was in a couple of weeks. And I think I had an emotional rock bottom in there where I decided to take my life because I thought I didn't have a formal education. I've earned millions. I'd lost lots of it at that point. I was ashamed of how I was behaving, and I never really physically had hurt anyone or stuff, but I just let myself down. And I was overweight. I couldn't go to the toilet all the time. I was a real physical mess as well. And I decided to take my life in there. And it was not dramatic. I didn't feel emotional. I was very calm. And I was like, I think I'm done. And I always weirdly said that I'm going to live to 40 and then I'm done.
Wow.
I never thought I was going to live after 40 anyway. Weird. I'd said it since a kid and I don't know why. But in there, this happened. I've said this before, but I had a phone call from a friend who jolted me into reality, I guess.
Yeah.
And I had a conversation, went back downstairs, to the process group in this hospital and heard a couple of things. And I was like, you know what? I can't do this to my mum. Can't do this to my nephews. I'm gonna give this a go. Whatever this is, sobriety, I don't know what it is, but I'm going to give it a go.
Yeah.
And I did. And since then, life's been incredible. So I went back into work to being a model, which is not really what you do at the age of 30. What was I, 35? Yeah, at the age of 35. And did better than I did before.
Yeah.
Because I really changed my mindset about being of service, about not trying to people please anyone, but being good at my job. And I wanted to be really good at my job. So yeah, it changed from a rock bottom. It kind of changed everything around.
Amazing, isn't it? That low self-esteem.
What would you advise for other people listening to our podcast? If someone's, two questions. If someone's in a drinking hole and they keep drinking and they know they're there, but they don't know what to do about it, what would you advise them to do? And if someone in the family's drinking, what would you do about that?
Well, I know from the family situation that you can't really get them sober yourself. because I tried that. You have to ask them to really try and, you know, make a phone call, get some help, because there's help out there. There is a solution out there. If they don't want help, it's very difficult, but because there's a few alcoholics where I live that I've tried to help, and one's completely yellow. It's such a sad situation. I've taken him to meetings. I've had him in to feed him, but he just will not give it 100%. He's not ready.
Yeah.
So for him and people like him, I'd say, you know, you are worth a good life. If only you could see. And he's only 30, in his 30s, this young guy. He looks about 50. I mean, you know, if only you could see the future a little bit further on, if you gave it up, that you'd have a good life.
Mm.
And you'd get your work back, and you get, you know, you won't lose your home. Your home won't be possessed. And all the things that go wrong when you're having a good old drink and you don't care about none of your bills, you know, all them things will come together great. I don't know. I think that's what it is for me. I just think, my goodness, I really was worth it all that time.
Mm-hmm.
I never knew I was. You know, I just went wherever. As I said, I had loads of masks, you know. I was one person one minute, another person. I didn't know who I was. It took this amount of recovery to make me know who I really am and to be okay with myself. You know, I've gone off the question. I've not answered the question, have I?
No, you have. No, but that's beautiful, because people don't realise that you can change everything. And in fact, you can enjoy life.
Yes, that's it.
You know, it's about enjoying it, because when you are drinking or using, it stops. It becomes very small.
Yeah.
Everything becomes a big thing.
Yes.
But life's very small.
Yeah.
And to come back into society, I think it's amazing.
Mm.
Thanks, Carol.
Thank you so much.
This podcast is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com, where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also make a donation. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. And if you enjoyed This Is Powerful, please rate, review, and follow the podcast to share it with your friends, your family, anyone you can, and head over to social media. I always love to see and hear how you react to the episodes, and it's so helpful for our content to be shared. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Frederica and Marty, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Henry, you know who you are, and to Emma Long, who does all the hard work in the background. And there's a whole catalogue of episodes wherever you get your podcasts. But did you know you can also watch it on YouTube? Just search for This Is Powerful with Paul Scofield.
Hi, I'm Joe Marler.
And I am Tom Fordyce.
And you can come and watch us at the Clapham Grand every month, performing our hit live podcast, Things People Did. Can we call it a hit podcast, Tom?
With a previous guest list of excellent comedians, including Maisie Adam, Joe Wilkinson, Sean Walsh, Fern Brady, and many more. I think that's a hit right there.
You're right, Tom. And we have more live shows coming up. Where else can you go and see amazing comedians talking about the normal jobs they used to do for only £15?
Exactly, Joe. Tickets are on sale now. Just search for Things People Did. What are you waiting for?